Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Thursday, May 26, 2022. Bipartisan Senate talks are underway on a response to the recent mass shootings, the one in Uvalde, Texas, an elementary school that left 19 students and two teachers dead, and at the food store in Buffalo, New York, where 10 African Americans were killed in an attack motivated by race. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy promising to work hard to find a compromise with the Republicans, but he says if none can be found, votes on Democratic anti-gun violence proposals will take place. The Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell saying he wants to find a bipartisan solution with reforms directly related to the shootings that just took place. Meanwhile, today, Senate Republicans blocking the start of debate on a bill to address domestic terrorism. It was put forth by Democrats as a response to the Buffalo shooting. Also in the news today, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack asked about high inflation's impact on farmers' incomes. Secretary of State Antony Blinken laying out the U.S. strategy to confront China's bid to spread its authoritarian influence. And a Senate committee holding a confirmation hearing for the nominee for the next NATO Supreme Allied Commander, talking about the military alliance's goals in Russia's war in Ukraine. The website 538.com has an article that includes this. Democrats have issued impassioned pleas for the government to more tightly regulate the sale of firearms. And if past shootings are any indication, we will soon get a fresh batch of polling data showing that solid majorities of Americans agree with them. But again, if past shootings are any indication, Congress will not pass any reforms, in large part because many Republicans oppose gun control reform. And as happened so many times before, the strong public support for gun control will fade away with our memories of the shootings. That was from 538.com. Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, has the task of leading the Democratic side of the negotiations to find any compromise with Republicans. He tells a Capitol Hill rally today that he will try, but if none can be found, the votes on the Democratic proposals will happen.
We are not prepared to allow the gun lobby and the gun industry to continue to run this town and this place. We are never, ever going to give up until we make our schools, we make our shopping malls, we make the streets of this country a safe place to live and work. We are never, ever giving up until we win this fight. And this is a choice. This is not inevitable. This is not unchangeable. We are the only country in the world in which our kids go to school wondering whether they will survive the day, right? My fourth grader yesterday had to have conversations all day at school with his classmates that no child, that no 10-year-old should have to have. And he is forced to have those conversations with his friends about where they will hide, about where they will run, because of decisions that are made in this place. And we're going to change those decisions. We are going to do two things. First, we are going to extend a hand of partnership to those who have been sitting on the sidelines, to those who have chosen to side with the gun lobby, and we are going to offer them a seat at the table. Right? Today, we will be engaged in bipartisan conversations to try to find a path forward to make our streets safer, to make our schools safer. And our goal and our hope and our belief is that we can find that common ground and that we will be facilitated in finding that common ground by a popular uprising of citizens who are going to make clear that if you don't do the right thing here, you aren't coming back here. But if we don't succeed, we're having votes. We're putting people on the record. One way or the other, we're going to have a debate here. We are going to force people to tell America which side they are on.
Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut, speaking at a rally and news conference on the grounds of the U.S. Capitol building today in Washington, an event titled Rally for More Than Thoughts and Prayers. was put together by the group Every Town for Gun Safety. NBC News reports the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer agreeing to give Murphy and the people surrounding him 10 days to reach a bipartisan deal on gun safety. Otherwise, the votes on those House-passed bills will come up. This from CNN. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell telling CNN on Thursday he met earlier in the day with Texas Senator John Cornyn and encouraged the senior Republican senator to begin discussions with Democrats, including Senators Chris Murphy of Connecticut and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, to see if they can find a middle ground on legislation to respond to the tragic Texas elementary school shooting. McConnell would not say specifically what the contours of the legislation should be, instead signaling he wants Cornyn to be one of the one to negotiate. McConnell telling CNN, "I met with Senator Cornyn this morning. As you know, he went home yesterday to see the family members and begin the fact-finding of this awful massacre. And I've encouraged him to talk with Senator Murphy and Senator Sinema and others who are interested in trying to get an outcome that is directly related to the problem. I am hopeful that we could come up with a bipartisan solution." That quote from Senator McConnell to CNN. Well, Senator John Cornyn now back in Washington, and he spoke on the floor today.
At times like this, words seem so inadequate. There's no good way to completely express the heartbreak and anger that swell in your chest at a moment like this. All we can say, perhaps, is that our condolences are with the families grieving such a cruel and unexpected loss. I can't fathom the pain of seeing an empty bed where your child slept the night before. Knowing we can't turn back the clock to prevent this tragedy from occurring, the obvious question then is, how do we prevent something like this from happening again? At this point, law enforcement is still investigating and piecing together the full story. In the coming days, I expect we will have better information about the shooter and its background and the circumstances that led to this senseless, brutal act. Once it does, I'm eager to see whether there are any gaps that might have done something to make this attack less likely, that might have actually even prevented this attack from taking place. In the past, I've worked with colleagues on both sides of the aisle to prevent senseless tragedies from occurring through things like Fix NICS and the Mental Health and Safe Communities Act. Fix NICS, you'll recall, occurred after the Sutherland Springs shooting, where the shooter was not, his criminal convictions were not uploaded by the Air Force into the National Instant Criminal Background Check. And so he was able to go to a local sporting goods store and buy weapons by lying and buying. And I'm convinced that working with Senator Murphy and all of our colleagues, we were able to get 70 or more co-sponsors on that bill because it actually addressed a real gap in the system, and it would actually give us some hope that we'd actually save lives in the future. I'm not interested in making a political statement. I'm not interested in the same old tired talking points. I'm actually interested in what we can do to make the terrible events that occurred in Uvalde less likely in the future. And now we don't know everything we need to know. But once we do, I expect there will be an informed debate about reforms we can make. And I look forward to participating in those discussions. For now, the focus should remain on supporting the people of this little community who suffered an immeasurable loss this week.
Senator John Cornyn, Republican from Texas, on the Senate floor. Ryan Grimm, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept, joining us on the phone, has an article that is titled, "Senator Chris Murphy Says Billions in Gun Violence Intervention Could Pass the Senate Under Reconciliation." Ryan Grimm, what did you find?
So as I'm sure most of your listeners know, reconciliation is the process that allows the Senate to pass things with just a simple majority, you know, just 50 votes. It requires it to be largely a budget-related item, which is why you can't do major policy changes through it. You know, Build Back Better, all of the policy changes in the Build Back Better Act, which occupied so much time last year, we're going through under reconciliation, which means that Republicans can't filibuster it. So Chris Murphy, and I asked a number of other senators as well, if they had looked at this. Tim Kaine told me that in the past they had actually looked pretty closely at this, and most of the kind of serious policy changes that you would need, say red flag laws, background checks, are not necessarily eligible for to go through under reconciliation unless you just overrule the parliamentarian, which Bernie Sanders suggested that they just go ahead and do that. What Chris Murphy pointed out was that if you go, say, I think he said North Hartford, for instance, in Connecticut, what the communities there are clamoring for are anti-gun violence programming, basically gun violence intervention programs that target at-risk communities and at-risk youth that are subject to all the different pressures that they're under. And with the right kind of programs, you can de-escalate a lot of the violence that is going on in these communities. And he had said that the president had at one point proposed $5 billion. All of that would be eligible to go through under reconciliation because it's a strictly budget matter. So it would just simply be a matter of them just writing it up. And while it wouldn't address necessarily the school shooting issue, although it could if you identified the right children who are at risk of becoming school shooters and were able to intervene in before their descent takes them to that place, then you don't have to start talking about, or you don't have to rely solely on hardening schools and arming teachers and all of the other kind of defensive mechanisms that are being talked about now. What Murphy was saying is you try to go to the root of it, try to make it so that people are not trying to walk into schools or are not getting into gunfights, at the basketball court or walking down the street. And $5 billion to go towards these evidence-based programs that have shown real effectiveness, could arguably save thousands and thousands of lives.
In terms of process, because reconciliation is not unlimited, this getting the anti-violence programs through would require an agreement on the other parts of Build Back Better. Is that true?
Yes and no. So if the entire thing falls apart, Build Back Better, which it may or may not, you've seen some reporting recently, you've seen Democrats expressing optimism that they're going to get to a deal. But let's say that they don't get to a deal. Well, if they don't, then that's a reconciliation vehicle that's still available. Because it didn't get used for Build Back Better, it would still be able to be used for something like this. So, and there are also several reconciliation vehicles that are available. The parliamentarian, I think it said in 2021, there could be three available. There seem to be more reconciliation vehicles available than the Senate has cargo to put in them.
We're talking with Ryan Grimm from The Intercept. We also learned today Senator John Cornyn and Senator Chris Murphy will be the lead negotiators trying to reach a bipartisan gun violence prevention compromise of some kind. From your reporting on this issue in general, how likely is that?
From my reporting in general, it's not very likely. But in particular, there does seem to be some serious energy. The emotions are extremely high in the Senate. You're seeing overtures from people like Cornyn, for instance, that you might not necessarily expect them from. But if you go back to post Sandy Hook, there has been nothing but disappointment after disappointment. Now, the National Rifle Association has almost completely collapsed. It will be a test of how much of the inability of the Senate to act on gun policy was directly a function of NRA lobbying rather than the cultural issues around the Second Amendment and the kind of talk of the re-election and the other more prosaic arguments that people make about gun rights in the United States generally, and how much of it is just quite specific to the NRA. So that's one thing that we'll find out.
Ryan Grimm, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for The Intercept. Find his stories at theintercept.com and on Twitter at Ryan Grimm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Washington Today. President Joe Biden saying yesterday that he'd be heading to Texas to grieve with the families in Uvalde in the coming days. We found out when that's going to be. The White House Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, saying it will be this Sunday.
And as you all saw, we announced that on Sunday, the President and the First Lady will travel to Uvalde to grieve with the community that lost 21 lives in the horrific elementary school shooting. We will have more to share as we get closer. But while he's there, the president will meet with the community leaders, religious leaders, and the families of the victim. The president and First Lady believe it is important to show their support for the community during this devastating time and to be there for the families of the victims.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre. Education Secretary Miguel Cardona giving his thoughts about the debate over the response to the mass shootings, especially in schools. He testified before the House Education and Labor Committee. This question from Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, Democrat from Florida.
Secretary Cardona, as you know all too well, the gun violence that's plaguing our schools and communities is just out of control. The citizens of this country have had enough of our thoughts and prayers. They deserve better. They deserve action. So we're here today for policy solutions and action. It's beyond time. It's beyond time that spineless Republican colleagues end their extramarital affair with the gun lobby and help us pass gun reform in this country. Instead, they offer senseless policies and that don't address the gun violence epidemic our communities are facing. Just yesterday, they were calling for arming teachers and resource officers. Mr. Secretary, like you, as a former school principal and teacher, we know that's not the answer. What does the department need from Congress to ensure that when kids pick up their pencils and take out their books, it won't be their last time doing so?
Thank you, Congresswoman. I'll tell you, I was a school principal during the Sandy Hook massacre, and the impact that that had in our community, I can't put it into words. Educators go to school to work, to help children socially, academically. We need to make sure that, number one, our professions are respected, and the solution of arming teachers, in my opinion, is further disrespect to a profession that's already beleaguered and not feeling the support of so many folks. We need to make sure we're empowering our teachers to be successful at teaching our children, and we need to work together. I think what Americans want to see is collaboration and bipartisan working together to do action. As you said, thoughts and prayers are not enough anymore. We need to stop that. We need to get to work. Americans are looking to us for answers, and we must deliver.
Education Secretary Miguel Cardona, questioned by Democratic Congresswoman Frederica Wilson at today's Education and Labor Committee hearing on the Education Department policies and programs. Senate Republicans today blocking a bill that would create domestic terrorism offices at the Departments of Homeland Security and Justice and the FBI, also require biannual reporting on domestic terrorism threats and assessments of the threat posed specifically by white supremacists and neo-Nazis. The bill put forth after the recent mass shooting in a black neighborhood in Buffalo by a self-described white supremacist. Here is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer supporting the bill and also promising that if the Republicans join him in starting the debate, then there could be both Democratic and Republican amendments offered dealing with gun violence.
The bill is so important because the mass shooting in Buffalo was an act of domestic terrorism. We need to call it what it is, domestic terrorism. It was terrorism that fed off the poison of conspiracy theories like white replacement theory. Terrorism that left 10 people dead, a community forever torn asunder. This bill will give the government the tools to monitor, find, and arrest these evil actors before they have a chance to inflict violence on their communities. And I thank my colleague, Senator Durbin, for championing this bill. I've been going to bed every night thinking about the families I met in Buffalo in the aftermath of the shooting. I think about this little 3-year-old boy. He lost his dad, who went to that Topps grocery store to buy him a birthday cake for his son. That little boy is going to live with that the rest of his life. And I think of all the families impacted by other racially motivated shootings over the years. Buffalo certainly and unfortunately wasn't the first. Charleston, El Paso, Pittsburgh, Atlanta, and so many others. The shooting of Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans, gay Americans, Jewish Americans, as well as Black Americans. All because of this horrible white replacement theory. So today is the day we can begin to debate on how to make these shootings less likely. And there's an additional benefit to moving forward today. It's a chance to have a larger debate and consider amendments for gun safety legislation in general, not just for those motivated by racism, as vital as it is to do that. I know that many members on the other side hold views that are different than the views on this side of the aisle. So, let us move on this bill. Let us proceed, and then they can bring them to the floor.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, today on the Senate floor. Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, rose to oppose this domestic terrorism bill.
This bill states, as if it were a fact, in the beginning of Section 5, that this bill will create an interagency task force to analyze and combat white supremacist and neo-Nazi infiltration of the uniformed services and federal law enforcement. This is not just an insult to your local police or to the Marines or to the Army and to the Navy. This is an insult to the FBI. It's an insult to the Capitol Police. This bill says that they've been infiltrated. This says that our police are consumed with some kind of race rage. It's untrue and it's slander and it's scandalous. But it's predictable. This is the party that wants to defund the police. But this party not only wants to defund the police, they think the police are full of hatred and racism. It's not true. Every policeman in our country, every soldier in our country should look at this bill and say, who are these people? White supremacy and neo-Nazi infiltration of the Marines? That's not true. It's an insult to every Marine in our country. It's an insult to every soldier in our country. It's an insult to every policeman in our country. It's an insult to the Capitol Police.
Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, on the Senate floor. The vote on moving forward with this bill, procedural vote, failed. 47 to 47. It was short of the 60 votes needed. No Republicans voted yes. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer changed his vote from yes to no at the end. It was also a procedural move. It allows him to bring the bill back up again, perhaps for another vote in the future. Senate today also voting down an attempt to overturn a new immigration regulation dealing with asylum from the Biden administration. It would give officers from U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, rather than immigration court judges, the power to consider migrant claims of fear of persecution or torture to get asylum. President Biden says it's needed to speed up processing of a backlogged asylum claim system. A simple majority vote was needed in the Senate, but the vote failed 46 to 48. This time, the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, the Republican, changed his vote from yes to no, allowing for a revote perhaps in the future. Sponsor of the resolution to repeal this regulation, Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin. He spoke before the vote.
This new rule that's about to take effect at the end of this month, the asylum rule, again, circumvents, is contrary to stated law that says immigration judges, immigration courts need to make that asylum determination. Not members of the administration, not USCIS officers. What this rule does is it gives that power to grant asylum, an awesome power that Congress never meant to give to the administration. It gives that power to USCIS officers and only allows a judge to take a look at that if the asylum claim is denied by the USCIS officer. So this isn't going to do anything to reduce the backlog. What this will do is this will increase the flow. This is another signal throughout the world that we have an open border policy. The only restraint right now is Title 42, and this administration is working actively to overturn a court order that said you must keep Title 42 restrictions in place. And if the USCIS officer isn't as generous as we fear they all will be and actually denies asylum, you're right back there in Article III courts. So the only purpose of this rule is to increase the flow to accomplish Secretary Mayorkas' stated goal of making sure that we have a safe, orderly, and legal pathway for individuals to be able to access our legal system. In other words, this administration's policy on the border isn't to secure it, isn't to reduce the flow, it's to make the processing and dispersing of illegal immigrants more efficient, so more will come.
Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin, on the Senate floor today, sponsor of this resolution to try to repeal the new asylum rule that he mentioned. That vote to repeal it failed. This week, as Senator Johnson mentioned, was to be the week that Title 42 was repealed. That's the regulation using the COVID-19 pandemic as the rationale to deny many migrants to the U.S. a chance to make a case for asylum. Biden administration wants to do away with it, but a judge has blocked that for now. The Homeland Security Secretary posting this video.
I am Alejandro Mayorkas, U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security. The United States continues to enforce its immigration laws. Individuals and families should not put their lives at risk by taking the dangerous journey only to be sent back. The restrictions at our southwest border have not changed. Single adults and families encountered will continue to be expelled where appropriate under Title 42. And those who are unable to establish a legal basis to remain will be removed. The U.S. Border Patrol already is managing numbers at historic levels due to large movements of people fleeing violence, corruption, poverty, climate change, and other hardships. And numbers could rise further from confusion over recent court orders and as smugglers continue to peddle misinformation to make a profit. We are prepared. The Department of Homeland Security is executing its comprehensive whole-of-government plan to manage current and potential increases at our border in a safe, orderly, and humane way, consistent with enforcing our laws. We are also deterring irregular migration south of our border in partnership with the Department of State, other federal agencies, and nations throughout the Western Hemisphere. The bottom line is that U.S. borders are not open. Individuals and families continue to be subject to border restrictions, including expulsion. Do not come to the border. Do not put your life at risk only to be sent back.
Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas in a video on Twitter this week. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. A few more headlines. Palestinian Authority says its investigation concluding that Israeli forces deliberately shot and killed a Palestinian-American journalist for Al Jazeera, Shireen Abu Akleh, 2 weeks ago as she was trying to flee. Israel's defense minister says the findings are a blatant lie and that no soldier fired intentionally at a journalist, and that she was shot during a battle between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian militants. And former U.S. President Donald Trump and two of his children, Ivanka and Don Jr., must answer questions under oath in New York State's civil investigation into the business practices of the Trump Organization. That ruling from a state appeals court today. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell today making what many reporters call a rare appearance at a committee hearing. It was the Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry Committee, getting testimony from the Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack about issues important to rural areas of the country. Senator McConnell asking the secretary about high inflation and what it's doing to farmers.
This inflation issue that we're all hammered with amounts to well over $5,000 of increased costs annually, including $780 in additional costs for food. In a rural state like mine, and a lot of the members of this committee have similar states, Small business and family farms are getting hit at both ends. In every single conversation I've had with farmers in the last year, the burden of increased input costs has been right in the forefront. One recent study from Texas A&M estimated that despite higher commodity prices, farm profits will drop by nearly 60% in 2022 due to these higher input costs. Since January of 2021, animal feed has increased by 43%, diesel fuel 115%, natural gas 202%, fertilizer 220%. Agencies like EPA, Interior, and others seem bent on driving these costs up even further. Have you worked with your colleagues across the administration to inform them how this regulatory onslaught is contributing to the burdens the farmers already have?
Senator, our focus at USDA is to try to figure out ways in which we can provide assistance and help on the number of issues that you've raised. First of all, we are looking at ways in which we can increase productive land going into production. Obviously, as Senator Bozeman indicated, supply does have a tendency, if you expand it, it has a tendency to help bring costs down and potentially increase income. Secondly, in terms of the fertilizer, there are a number of things that we're doing. We are working with farmers to make sure that they are fully aligned with the right application, the right time, the right location, the right amount. We have also provided a new risk management tool that encourages split application of nitrogen to reduce the cost to farmers with picking up the loss of productivity that may occur if they are unable to fertilize twice in a year. We also have allocated $500 million towards looking at a broad array of options in terms of how we might be able to expand fertilizer capacity in this country and not be as reliant and as reliant as we have been on outside sources for fertilizer. And we're also looking at a number of strategies in terms of ways in which we can better utilize precision agriculture to ensure that we are using fertilizer in the appropriate time and appropriate amount. So there's a series of things that we're doing. We're also, and I would only finish by saying, part of our responsibility is also to provide help and assistance to the families that, as you mentioned, are struggling. That's the reason why it's important to get the SNAP program where it is. It's important to continue to promote the WIC bonus buy that we have in our budget. It's appropriate to take a look at ways in which we can help our schools deal with the consequences of all of this. That's why we asked for a continuation for one more year of universal free school meals. We think that there are a number of ways in which we can provide help and assistance to families to get through this difficult time.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, questioning the Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack at today's Senate Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry Committee hearing. Secretary Vilsack referring to the free school lunches for all students. That's been funded through the COVID-19 pandemic relief bills that have been passed in the past few years. That is slated to expire June 30th, but several Democrats, including the chair of the Agriculture Committee, Debbie Stabenow, Democrat of Michigan, looking for a way to extend it, perhaps as part of the next COVID-19 program funding bill that the Senate does have under consideration. The head of the Food and Drug Administration, Dr. Robert Califf, back on Capitol Hill today to discuss the Biden administration's response to the infant formula shortage nationwide. Yesterday it was a House committee, today the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. He says he expects the overall shortage to end within 2 months, and specialty formulas should be available within a month. But he says the question going forward is, should the federal government stockpile for the future?
The big question that I think is going to have to be addressed is, do we create a stockpile as a backup in case something doesn't work in the future? I do worry. What happens is, if we're getting the Abbott plant back up, there are positive cultures would be one example. I think we're going to have a surplus. We're certainly planning on a surplus within a couple of months, as I've already told you. The question is, should we maintain that surplus as a government activity for the foreseeable future? And that's a question we're all going to have to discuss together and make a decision about.
Part of the blame for the shortage is a shutdown at a plant in Michigan run by the company Abbott. And Senator Bernie Sanders today, independent from Vermont, asking Commissioner Califf whether there may be criminal liability in that case.
October 20th of last year, a whistleblower sent a 34-page report to the FDA describing in detail how the equipment in Abbott's manufacturing plant in Michigan, quote, was failing and in need of repair, and that the company knew that this was a problem for at least 5 years. According to this report, Abbott falsified records to cover up deficiencies at its plant, improperly trained employees, and successfully hid health and safety risk from FDA auditors in 2019. And even though this report was submitted to your agency last October, FDA did not interview the whistleblower until late December. Now, my question is, during that same period of time, Abbott saw a $7 billion increase in its profits, and its CEO, Mr. Ford, saw very substantial increases in his compensation packages. If a company lies to the FDA about its safety situation, at the same time it does massive stock buybacks, gives the CEO used compensation packages, are you going to fine them? What are you going to do to make sure the industry understands that you simply cannot lie to a government agency?
The whistleblower's complaint was received, and the usual staff reviewed it and did the interview. It was not escalated to the leaders of the FDA who were responsible, and that was an error that's now been rectified in terms of process. In terms of the status of the whistleblower complaint, I'm not in a position to comment on whether they may be legal proceedings.
I'm not even asking about the whistleblower complaint. If a major corporation lies to the FDA about something as terribly important, the safety of infant formula, what are you going to do? And at the same time, they do billions in stock buybacks, huge compensation packages for its CEO. Is the government, is the agency going to say, sorry, it is more important to protect the babies of this country than to give huge compensation packages to your CEOs? Are you going to stand up to them?
Senator Sanders, we are standing up to them. As I said, I'm not in a position to say whether criminal proceedings are underway or not.
Is that something in consideration?
I'm just not in a position to comment on.
Well, I would hope that manufacturers of baby formula, which is so terribly important to parents and obviously the babies, understand they cannot lie to the Food and Drug Administration. And I hope you are strong about that.
Well, Senators, you know, I've worked on all sides of this. I've been inspected. And everyone understands when you lie to the FDA and you get caught, there's going to be big trouble.
Well, I hope there will be. Thank you.
Senator Bernie Sanders, independent from Vermont, questioning the Food and Drug Administration Commissioner, Dr. Robert Califf, at today's Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee hearing. On Wall Street, the Dow up 516, NASDAQ up 305, S&P up 79. From the New York Times, Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Thursday that despite Russia's invasion of Ukraine, China remains the greatest challenger to the United States and its allies, and that the Biden administration aims to shape the strategic environment around the Asian superpower to limit its increasingly aggressive actions. The article goes on, the speech was a much shorter public version of the administration's classified strategy on China, which was largely completed last fall. Secretary Blinken speaking at George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
This is a charged moment for the world. And at times like these, diplomacy is vital. It's how we make clear our profound concerns, better understand each other's perspective, and have no doubt about each other's intentions. We stand ready to increase our direct communication with Beijing across a full range of issues. And we hope that that can happen. But we cannot rely on Beijing to change its trajectory. So we will shape the strategic environment around Beijing to advance our vision for an open, inclusive international system. President Biden believes this decade will be decisive. The actions that we take at home and with countries worldwide will determine whether our shared vision of the future will be realized. To succeed in this decisive decade, the Biden administration's strategy can be summed up in three words: invest, align, compete. We will invest in the foundations of our strength here at home, our competitiveness, our innovation, our democracy. We will align our efforts with our network of allies and partners, acting with common purpose and in common cause. And harnessing these two key assets, we'll compete with China to defend our interests and build our vision for the future.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken, part of his speech on U.S.-China policy today at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. President Biden, during his just completed trip to Japan and South Korea, introducing an effort to shape the environment around China, the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, an agreement between the U.S. and 12 Asian nations. Secretary Blinken also saying today during a speech, China is the only country with both the intent to reshape the international order and increasingly the economic, diplomatic, military, and technological power to do it. And Secretary Blinken announcing the creation of a China House in the State Department, a team of diplomats to coordinate U.S. policy dealing with China. Russia's ongoing war in Ukraine, a major topic today as the Senate Armed Services Committee considered the nominee for the next NATO commander, General Christopher Cavoli. Cavoli is currently commanding General U.S. Army Europe and Africa. Senator Dan Sullivan, Republican from Alaska, asking the nominee about his experience dealing with Russia and also NATO's goals in Ukraine.
I believe you are exceptionally well qualified for this position. I'd like you to brag a little bit, if you don't mind. Can you just let the committee and the American people know some of your background and experiences and education as it relates to Russia?
Asking me to brag is the hardest question you could ask me, Senator.
Go ahead. We want you to brag. I want you to brag.
So
very impressive. Just Russia focus, education.
Sure. I graduated at Princeton in 1987, where I did not look at Russia. I graduated with a degree in biology. I entered the Army. I immediately was stationed in Italy with the Parachute Infantry Battalion. In that role, we studied Russia closely because that was our main opponent during the end of the Cold War. As I came out of company command, sir, I became a Russian foreign area officer. My wife and I studied Russian together at the Defense Language Institute for a year. Then I went to...
So you speak Russian?
I do. Yes, I do.
And you've studied Russian military history, Russian strategy,
I got a degree
Russian
from
tactics.
Yale University in Russian.
You've had billets that have solely focused on Russia?
I have lived in Moscow for months at a time. I have traveled all over the former Soviet space. I have had fellowships at the George Marshall Center.
In Germany.
I was the on the Russia desk for the Joint Staff.
So I would say Russia desk for the Joint Staff?
I was, sir.
So that's every day getting up, focusing on Russia's, the challenges?
Absolutely, Senator.
So I would say you are Vladimir Putin's worst nightmare in... couldn't be more qualified than probably any other member of the military. So, again, I want to thank you for your service. Can you clearly define succinctly, because I have a bunch of questions, our top strategic goals in Ukraine?
Yes, Senator. We want Ukraine to emerge from this conflict independent and free. We want the NATO alliance to be unified and as strong as ever. And we want to do these things without engaging in a war with Russia.
Thank you.
Senator Dan Sullivan, Republican from Alaska, and General Christopher Cavoli, nominated for commander of U.S. European Command and NATO Supreme Allied Commander Europe at today's confirmation hearing. Associated Press reporting that Russian President Vladimir Putin says the West will fail in its attempt to isolate Russia and face growing economic problems. Speaking Thursday via video link to members of the Eurasian Economic Forum, Putin said Russia wasn't going to shut itself off from international cooperation. The forum includes several ex-Soviet nations. Putin said that trying to isolate Russia is impossible, utterly unrealistic in the modern world, and those who try to do it primarily hurt themselves. That from AP. More from the hearing with the nominee for NATO commander, General Cavoli, questioned by Senator Josh Hawley, Republican from Missouri, about Finland and Sweden's application to join the military alliance and what that may mean for U.S. troop deployments to Europe.
When we talked last week, you told me that you didn't expect Finland's and Sweden's admission to NATO to result in U.S. force requirements in Europe. I've seen since then reports that Sweden is requesting a greater U.S. naval presence in the Baltic Sea, also seeing reports the Pentagon plans to keep 100,000-plus troops in Europe for the foreseeable future. I just want to revisit this topic that you and I discussed in light of those reports. I mean, given this, how confident are you that Finland's and Sweden's accession to NATO would not result in U.S. forces doing more in Europe than we are currently obligated to under our current NATO commitment?
So the 100,000 forces in Europe that are being extended, that's part of this surge that we performed over the last few weeks, Senator, and was not related to the question of Finland and Sweden joining NATO. I remain of the opinion, as I told you in our office call, that at least in the ground domain, that this is not going to be a requirement for large additional forces or additional forces. I think exercises and occasional presence, like we do with any ally, will increase.
Different basing requirements, do you think? I mean, will this necessitate a shift in posture by our forces or NATO forces?
I don't know right now, and I would point out that the word basing carries with it an enormous number of other implications that I would have to consider deeply before I came back to you with a firm response on basing.
General Christopher Cavoli, nominated for Supreme Allied Commander Europe. Getting questioned by Senator Josh Hawley, Republican from Missouri, at the Armed Services Committee hearing today on his nomination. If confirmed, General Cavoli would be the 20th Supreme Allied Commander Europe since NATO's founding. The first was General Dwight D. Eisenhower right before he was elected president, 1951 and 52. You can find this full hearing and everything you hear on the C-SPAN networks in its entirety at our video library at cspan.org. And thanks for listening to Washington Today. If you want more top Washington stories sent to you each day, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word. Just go to c-span.org/connect to sign up. Have a good night.